This session is called Some of My Best Friends Are Politicians. And before we start it, I would just like to ask if there is anyone in this room who has either held public office or now holds public office, an elected office. Okay, and what is that? School board, all right. So we have a real politician in the room. And you see, since I came to Holden, she's gotten to be sort of a friend of mine, and I didn't even know she was a politician. Must be certain personality characteristics. You will see why, I think, in a few minutes why I asked that question. The fact is that there's one in almost every crowd. Let me ask the second question. Whether there is somebody here who knows an elected official really well, who could say of that person, he's one of my real friends. I really know him.
Okay. What if you just know them?
Well, if you know them, that's the next level. If you don't like, you know them, but don't like them.
No, it's a bald weevil.
All right. Well, by way of introduction, let me just say that I'm Duane Scribner. I live in Minneapolis. I'm on the staff here as a literature person with an interest in politics. I have been here now for 2 weeks and have another week to go. I come to my interest in politics in the following way. I once was a teacher of English and then became administrative assistant or chief of staff in the office of a fairly new U.S. senator named Walter F. Mondale in 1967. Returned from there and served a little time in the academic environment of the University of Minnesota, and then joined the staff of a brand new governor of Minnesota named Wendell Anderson in 1971, and stayed there with a little time off to go back to the University of Minnesota until 1977. On the basis of those experiences, I was asked to join the corporate staff of Dayton Hudson Corporation, which is a fairly good-sized retailer, seventh largest in the country, based in Minneapolis, as a person working out of their external affairs, community relations, government relations, and community giving department. So for the past 5 years, I have spent my time in that position as a director of public affairs and most recently, Director of National Programs and Policy Planning, with the major responsibility of helping to translate Dayton Hudson's objectives into public sector opportunities, and also to bring to Dayton Hudson a perspective on the public side and the kinds of decisions that are being made, in government, especially at the national level, but not entirely there. I came to my assignment at Dayton Hudson with some books in an effort to use literature, among other things, to illustrate some things about living the politics of hope, particularly as it might apply to something that I've learned the title of today, I must say, thanks to Walter Stewart, Civil Politics, I now call it, as opposed to any other kind, that which is out there in the world. In fact, one of the most interesting things that happened to me this past week was that today Walter Stewart said that, remember now I've been at Holden 2 weeks, Walter Stuhr said that involvement in civil politics is a very Lutheran practice. And that explains some things to me. He may want to explain more about what he meant, maybe in self-defense a little later on, but that explains some things. It explained why I think a number of the people I know and admire who are actually in politics as public officials are Lutheran, as well as being Methodists and Catholics, and most of them, incidentally, are Catholic, the ones I know. But that's probably because I'm a Democrat, and in Minnesota, Catholics tend to make up about half of the Democratic constituency. I say that was one of the more interesting things that happened to me, because up until that time, I had begun to get the feeling from 2 weeks at Holden that the kind of politics in which I'm interested and in which I've been involved is an environment to sort of use a saying in a new Holden context, sort of an environment where a lot of people think that fools rush in where angels fear to tread. So I am here tonight to talk about the subject, to discuss with you the subject entitled "Some of My Best Friends Are Politicians." That is a title, as you might have guessed, that has several levels of meaning. The first place, it is literally true because of the background and interest, lifelong interest and professional background that I have. And I like titles with several meanings, I think, because I'm an English teacher, so I've managed to blend my two worlds together. Also, that title, we had a little groupthink about that title, and the title could easily have been "Some of Your Best Friends Are Politicians." In the broadest meaning of that, in light of the summer theme here of living the politics of hope, that at least is my prejudice. And to use the "Some of My Best Friends Are" line, of course, is also to suggest a little bit of the distrust and hostility that may border on something related to prejudice that some people feel about people who do this kind of work. It is a great many of the people who are in politics whom I know, when they become infuriated, about the treatment that the media and the general populace seems to give what they consider to be a calling in which they're working very hard but somehow can't communicate that effectively. I think that one of the biggest surprises I had in leaving the active political arena professionally, going from a governor's office to a corporation, is that when I went to work for Dayton Hudson, suddenly I became an expert. When I worked in government, especially if you work in a state capital like Minnesota's, where 50% of the people live within 35 miles and a no-charge, a no-toll telephone call from the office, you begin to understand that most of them believe that they know considerably more about what you should be doing than you do, which I think is one of the healthy things about American politics. For whatever reason, there is a tendency not to leave politics to the politicians. And feeling, I think, on the part of a great many people, and it is justified in our system, that if you do that, if you do leave politics to the politicians, you are leaving yourself unprotected. There is a sign over one of the doors of one of the offices in the Capitol which says no man's life, property, or pocketbook is safe while the legislature is in session. And that is a politician's joke. But you can see, I think, where it comes from. So let me be forthright in getting into this discussion about a couple of things. I hope, by the way, that this discussion is going to be just that. I'm here to help you. That's what politicians all say, isn't it? But I really am. I hope that those of you who have questions about the civil politics as an environment and as a place in which, by nature of all the things that you do, and especially when you're looking at something like a nuclear holocaust, you must somehow be tempted to be involved or feel forced to be involved. But I hope if you have questions about that world that you will ask them, and I'll try to be as good a resource as I can. And also, I'm going to try to limit myself to no more than about another 10 minutes, even though I have more notes here for this presentation than I've had for any of my others. I'm going to try to get through them very quickly and leave plenty of time for your comments and reactions and questions. I just want to tell you that I'm not easily offended. First of all, let me just say a couple of things about myself, to be straight up front with you. One, I like working in the world, and I love politics. I have never had a job working with or around public officials that I didn't like, and that includes the one I like now. Now, most of those jobs have some very unpleasant aspects connected with them, but they do not relate, as far as I'm concerned, to being involved in a political environment. I also like politicians, and I have liked them for years. And while I can't say I've never met a politician I didn't like, I also can't say that about pastors and teachers and philosophers and other people. Third thing is that one of the things that is often said about me by those who have the responsibility of trying to pass judgment on my activity in one way or another, either at work or elsewhere, is that I like to be where the action is. I do like that. I do like the environment where decisions are made. I like having the opportunity to make a difference that is a real difference, and to try to influence what happens in the civil political environment in a direction I want to go. I want it to go. And I like, having the opportunity to try. I'm basically an activist in that sense. And I believe that almost everyone who is seriously in politics is an activist of some sort. It does not say that they share the same ideologies, but I believe that they are basically activists who want to be involved and want to be a part of decision making. I share that, I think, with everybody I know who works in and around politics. Fourth, I'm basically optimistic on an ongoing basis and on a long-term basis. There are very few people who get really pessimistic and discouraged who can stay in because the work is too hard and the pay is too poor and the criticism is too great. And it's not an environment in which you can keep on working very long if you don't think it's possible to accomplish something. I should make a slight distinction. There are people who actually come into politics to cut down the role of government. And I don't consider those to be people to be pessimists. I think they're very optimistic simply because they feel that they might be able to accomplish that. And some of them do. Some of them do. We're seeing some of that right now. But I basically see problems as something to be solved. I see people who divide us instead of uniting us, whatever we might mean by that at a given time, as people who we either want to attempt to change or remove from positions where they can do us harm. I think a political campaign is a great opportunity to take somebody out of there who isn't doing the right thing from my viewpoint. And that I say that believing that that is the way the American electoral and political system was set up. And we are, the fact is that almost everyone in office, in elected office, serves with a very tiny majority, is elected with a very tiny majority, serves at the mercy of a small percentage of his electorate who, if they cross over to the other side, can throw him out. 52% is a respectable, winning margin in most elections, especially at the local level, but also at state and to a great extent at the federal level. And while that may come in some states may mean millions of votes, it also means that 48% of the people didn't want you to be there in the first place. And that is not an environment which in which you feel you have a mandate. And if you are, if you can behave as if you did in that environment, that we call leadership. I think, for instance, of the last presidential election in which President Reagan received a majority of the vote of those who voted, but was in fact elected by approximately 29% of the electorate in this country. Another 25%, I believe it was, or something like that, voted for Jimmy Carter, and another 4% somewhere, some of those numbers are not exactly right. But the fact is that a huge number of us stayed home. And the margin, it's not only the margin by which you live, by which you won, but also your sense of the margin, but the number of people who really support you. Most people in government as elected officials are in minority positions in terms of their total electorate. I think the elections are terrific. I love advocacy. It is our system, and it is something that I enjoy, and I think you have to enjoy it to really like politics. I really believe in lobbying. And I must say that I also believe in helping to finance the campaigns of good candidates. Those are all things that I learned to think are important. And I'm happy to answer questions or talk about any of those things a little later on. Finally, I think it is very difficult to be responsible as an elected official in our country, especially more difficult at sometimes than others. And I think it is absolutely essential to be responsible at the same time about what you say and do in those offices, that there aren't any quick fixes on the important problems that face us, whatever they are. I for instance, I think it's just as hard to close a school if you're on a school board as it is to as it is to do most of the things that people in Congress do. I can't think of an environment for an elected official today that isn't very difficult. And I don't think it is and I don't think it is an appropriate response to say, well, they all knew what they were getting into. They don't have to be run for office if they don't want to do it. That's true. Many of them are there because they really want to try to do something about it, and they still find it difficult. I also believe that if you're open and you're in elected office, that you can make mistakes. You can be wrong from time to time without doing any serious damage because of the nature of our system, because it's so full of checks and balances, and that makes risks worth taking for elected officials. And the ones, I think, who are the most effective and enjoy what they are doing the most are the ones that are willing to take those risks. And if I were pursuing the issue of nuclear disarmament, for example, it is exactly those people that I'd be looking for. I would not be going to the person who has a safe seat and doesn't want to do anything with it and hasn't for 20 years. I would not try to activate a dead politician. in my cause. I would go for the ones who are already active and probably doing something else that they think is important, but you might not think is so important. I like challenging, being challenged. I'm not easily offended. It always helps in political work not to be easily offended. And I find people elected to office to be a lot like you and me. They're smart about some things. They're ignorant and often quick to condemn others. About the when they don't know very much. They're mostly honest, sometimes very dishonest. They're mostly devoted to doing the right thing and very dependent on others to help them. The greatest mistake I think we make in thinking about American politicians is to think that they're not accessible to us, because the fact is that they cannot make their decisions without a lot of help, and if we've got it, they'll use it if it helps them do something they want to do. And also believe they're committed to moving society one way or another in an environment that requires them to go before the people every 2 or 4 years to give an accounting of themselves and risk what is one of the most humiliating and threatening experiences that anyone can have, to be publicly reviled and publicly humiliated by losing. That is, you know, we do that to people all the time. I've been involved indirectly in a losing election, major election, with someone that for whom I worked very hard while he was an elected official. And I can tell you that it is traumatic. And it is a risk that I admire people for taking. And that you might be humiliated by those people you represent, realizing at the same time that they haven't given you either the salary or the respect you might think that you deserve for making a good faith effort to do the job. It's fun. Politics and government, but it can really be bad. One or two other quick things. Almost everyone in America, I don't know why I should be considered, you know, set myself up as some kind of expert on politicians. Almost everyone in America either is an elected official or knows one. I think that's why 4 out of 5 Americans have a very low opinion of Congress, for example, but at the same time a very high opinion of their U.S. representative. That's one of the great anomalies in American public opinion. It's the way the system works. 2/3 of them think that their specific representatives are doing a good job. One of the myths about politicians in this country is that they have great power. I think in many ways American politicians, the elected officials, have never been in weaker positions than they are at the present time. Congress and the presidency are only one example. Both have been weakened very severely in the last few years by Watergate, and in addition to that, by some of the scandals in Congress. But beyond that, things have really changed. The all-powerful committee chairman is no longer all-powerful, either in the Senate or the House. They have to negotiate instead of giving directives. They are removed. They are criticized by people in their own party. And the system itself, compared to that in almost every other representative democracy in the world, in the United States, is one which diffuses power. We have nothing compared to the power of a prime minister in this country. Prime minister of England, of the prime minister in the House of what? Commons, can actually force a representative to vote against the obvious best interests of the people in the district from which he's elected, because he can decide who's going to run in that district. Not something the people decide. That's a lot of comparing our system with those of many others really leads you to understand that we don't like government in this country, and we never have. We've always kept it weak. We don't think that way most of the time when things aren't going the way we want them to go or when our ox is gored, but that's true. We'll talk about that more later if you want to. It's ironic to me that we have great laments today about the power of the federal government when, in fact, it is weak. We can't even make a decision about whether to have guns or butter. We heard a lot of talk about how people want to have guns and butter. I think where we are, butter is interpreted a little different way from what it was in Lyndon Johnson's times. But it's very clear to me that as a nation, our Congress cannot decide whether it cannot decide to make a decision on the side of guns and against tax decreases. You know, the fact is that we got both. We have one of the reasons our economy is in so much trouble. And the deficit looks so big, is that we did both. And that's what happens when you don't have power, when you can't get that decision made, when you're too weak. Let's see. Few American politicians started out to be government people, government leaders. I think that's another thing we need to realize. I've always thought there was a great similarity between elected officials and actors. I shouldn't have used it. It just dawns on me what I said. There is a performance, there is an ego and a desire for accolades and a willingness to go out and take the chance that you're going to close in Peoria, to apply the metaphor to politics and so on. And at the same time, there are also other people. There are also people in politics. The people take great risks to be in elected office, risks of all things I said. There are also those who will do almost anything to avoid losing an election. Might as well face up to that, too. Politicians are usually easy to work with, willing to listen, eager to get good ideas. Now, let me tell you that they don't particularly like to waste time when they don't have enough of it to get their job done. But I find them to be very patient with constituents and lobbyists and special interests and everyone, unless something happens. Unless they are cheated in the sense that they are given information which is bad and rely on it and trust the people who give it to them and then find out that it's wrong. I've always thought it was crazy to think that anybody who lobbies, whether it's for in the public interest or for what you folks think of as special interests, I've never found anything but special interests at work in legislatures and Congress. It just depends. It's always the other folks, you know, who are the special interests, the ones who want things that you don't think they should have. But it was strange that people would think that lobbyists, in the long run, especially in the environment we've had for the last 25 years, could be effective by lying to members of Congress, because there's nothing more lonely than trusting bad information and using it and finding yourself in debate with someone on the floor of a government body, and you're wrong. The other thing they don't like is to be threatened. It seems to me that if I were going to try to make an ally out of a politician, the last thing I would do, I might do it, but the last thing I would do after I tried everything else was to threaten to try to beat him in the next election. Get much further if you try to show them how the thing that you want is also something that his constituents want or should want or would want if it were explained adequately to them, and that it therefore can be something that he or she wants. That is a simple persuasion operating at its best level. And the fact is then there's another obligation that goes along with that. It seems to me that if you then realize that a member of Congress needs your help to do his job, to make his advocacy work, you can follow through and you can help that representative look good. That means, you know, that when somebody back home starts to raise Cain with him about the position he took because you asked him to, that you defend him or her. It means that you don't only wait and be passive and respond to that when it comes up, that you might actually, you know, get back into your own community and make sure they know what a good job that elected official, whoever it is, has done on behalf of the community that you are both, that you both represent. And let them know what you are doing together. In an election time, you might be able to explain, help him or her explain that what you're doing together is the right thing when others think it's wrong. If you do that, you're going to have a trusting ally. And the elected official is going to have a trusted ally. Now let me tell you that that won't keep you from getting an invitation to a fundraiser. It won't substitute for that at all. And that is another part of whole thing. It'll certainly, having that kind of relationship, however, will certainly help you understand whether you should contribute or not. And finally, everything that I've heard the last 2 weeks affirms to me something that I have always thought, which is that, to use the language of This Summer at Hope, that the politics, living the politics of hope, inevitably involves living the civil politics of our society. That everything that I hear people saying they want to happen requires public decisions and requires changes in attitudes among the people who make public decisions. It requires both those people and us to have a broader and broader view of what it is. I think the most striking thing that I've politically that I've heard this week is the strong emphasis on the international political issue. The question of of mechanisms that will help us to keep the world from blowing up, that now have to be international, that may require us to think in different ways about what's happening, and not so different. You know, the European Economic Community is a place where nations have given up their sovereignty in one way in order to serve their own interests. The United Nations is, in a way, that kind of organization. And I really believe that if it is indeed Lutheran to be interested in civil politics, that one of the things that be a good thing for Lutherans to be doing would be to figure out how to be more effective in that environment. And I'm here to help you do that. Yes?
When your old boss, Walter Mondale, becomes President of the United States and you become Secretary of State, what changes are you going to make?
I can predict something right now, and that is that I will never be Secretary of State. I see I gave you a politician's answer.
That's the confusion that we're offering.
Yes. Right.
Could you give us a brief character sketch of Fritz Mondale or just some general impressions
right.
you have?
Well, let me tell you what impressed me about him when I went to work for him. I should tell you that Walter Mondale was practically a total stranger to me when I went to work for him. Yeah, I thought of starting out this session by saying I was called. I got a call. The fact is, I did. I got a telephone call one snowy morning in December of 1966 after the November election, which was a very bitter election in Minnesota, within Minnesota, as well as on the Vietnam War issue. And I was a graduate student at the University of Minnesota at that time. And he asked me to have lunch with him. Now, I had met Walter Mondale in a receiving line here and there. We have a picture at home that shows something that I didn't believe when I saw it at the time, and that is, I saw the picture, and that is that he had been in our home while he was Attorney General for one of those coffee parties that you have for people who are running for office where you invite the neighbors in. But he did not know me when he saw me. I knew him when I saw him. And so we had lunch. So that's where I really first met him. Then I went to work for him. I had never been in Washington except to go to two meetings at the U.S. Office of Education. I did not know where the Senate office building was. I did not know what an administrative assistant did. I did not know anything when I went out there. And it was pure hell for about 6 months finding out. One of the things I discovered at an early point is that six people on his staff thought they were going to get the job I got. And but after that period of time, it is the most wonderful job I ever had. It was a real liberation and opening up for me of opportunity and my awareness of what it was possible to do. But so I got in. I owe Walter Mondale a lot in that sense, and I just want to put that perspective on it. I'll tell you a few things about Walter Mondale. Walter Mondale is the son of a small-town Methodist minister. In fact, several small-town Methodist minister, who went from parish to parish, sometimes two or three at a time, across south-central Minnesota while Walter was growing up. Fritz Mondale was part of that minister's second family. He has a lot of older relatives who are children of first wife of his father. He was widowed and remarried, had two families. His father, who was a Methodist minister, grew up Lutheran. And I believe it's either Fritz Mondale's grandfather or great-grandfather who was a Lutheran pastor. Not sure. Someone in there is part of what I call the professional church. You could see, when I first knew Walter Mondale, one of the things that impressed me about him that I found out about him, I did not know this about him, since I knew him as an attorney who'd been attorney general and who did a lot of things about consumer protection. And while I thought consumer protection was important, I thought there were a lot more important issues than that the U.S. senators might be involved in, and I hadn't seen too much evidence in 2 years that Walter Mondale was too interested in those things. Around the University of Minnesota, one of those precious academic environments that I've been in from time to time, he was looked on as a lightweight. Well, I found out he wasn't. I found out that he was very strongly motivated in what I have to call a social gospel orientation. His guts are in the issues of social justice, injustice, and all of that sort of thing. And he's a person who acts that out. He is also one of the, as a senator, I found him to be, just glad he didn't become a prosecuting attorney and that I didn't commit a crime that I had to be, that I had to be prosecuted for, because he is one of the most incisive people I know. He just cuts right into things and right through things. And about the time he asks the fourth question, I can see where he was leading when he asked the first question. And of course, the person he's questioning in the committee of Congress, or questioned in the committee of Congress, was probably didn't see it until about the sixth, and then it was far too late. A very, very bright and very issue-oriented. That's how I remember it. You'd have to call him a Kennedy liberal in the Great Society sense. In those days, he was, when Bobby Kennedy, who was a good friend of his, was killed, he took over a couple of Bobby Kennedy's assignments, one on the Indian Education Subcommittee and one on the migrant labor. Those are the kinds of issues he's involved with, along with the international trade. Yes?
Just to prove you're not biased, can you tell us some of his faults?
Yes. Yeah, I think if Walter Mondale has, he has some faults. One of them is that he becomes obsessed with the things that he really is interested in. He has a little trouble getting distance and perspective from them sometimes, and feels them, I would say, almost too strongly, and sort of blinds him to from time to time to other things. The other thing about him is that he's, in my experience, he is a very cautious person. I think he's less cautious now than he started out, and I suppose that may happen to you. I don't know now that, since I don't know him very much in relation to him, to the vice presidency, and now this interest in the presidency, how much how he is about risk-taking, but while I was with him, I thought he passed up a couple of really great opportunities. You know, it's a sort of a matter. One of the things was he could be, have become part of the President's Commission on Civil Disorders at the time that was created after the riots in Detroit, and declined it, and Senator Harris from Oklahoma took that job. Senator Harris is no longer a viable politician, and Walter Mondale is, so who am I to say? But I did get that sense that sometimes trains passed him by. Those are the two most prominent things I think about.
You had some very positive comments to make on politicians. Would you say that the Midwestern politicians may be more positive in our respect, in our view of looking
well,
at
I'll tell
it
you,
than some
if I,
of the...
If I lived in a region where Mark Hatfield and Bob Packwood, two Republicans, came from, I would really be working on those people. I think they are both people of extremely, from what I know of them, extremely high caliber, good people.
What about some of the South and Eastern board ones? Seems to me they're always got their hand in graft and corruption.
Senator Javits. Let's talk about graft and corruption a little bit. Let's talk about that. There's a lot of temptation there. There are 435 members of the House and 100 members of the Senate, 535 people out there. They all have great public reputations at stake. They all have the opportunity to be corrupt. Some of them are, as I said at the beginning, some of them are very dishonest. I find in that regard that while a public office may be a public trust, that they are about as likely to be honest or dishonest as the other people I know. Now they're in a position, I mean, we might argue about how much power they have. You might think they have a lot more than I do. But they are in a position where they, where because of the power that they do have, the influence that they do have, being corrupt may be more important. The ethics of that is something that I feel very strongly. I think if you take Abscam, for instance, if I'm not mistaken, there isn't one of those people left in public office. We have a system which can remove them. They do those things at great risk, especially now, maybe more now than in the past. But yes, I think there are dishonest politicians. Yes.
Can you talk about the electoral count?
The electoral college probably won't change, I guess. And I think that that's the system by which we elect a president, which means that you carry states, and if you carry a state, you carry all the electoral votes for that state, which are the number equal to the number of U.S. representatives and senators that you have. It doesn't make any difference if you win that by one vote, that state, or whether you win it by a million votes, you still get the same number of electoral votes. There's been a lot of talk about changing it to be proportional representation. And I guess one of the reasons that I think that's very unlikely to happen is that it is a way that seems to work of forcing decisions in elections. It served a very practical purpose. It has been off in terms of who would have been elected president, I think, once or twice in history. And we keep thinking it's going to happen again. Every election recently, because elections are so close, we think it's going to happen again. It never does.
It seems to me that one thing more important than the Electoral College and about the elections on a national scale is this television, and they're projecting who's going to be the winner, and there's 3 hours difference in time between the East Coast and the West Coast, and some people just give up and say, well, we got a winner, why vote?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a legitimate issue. We first tried to deal with that in Senator Mondale's office when I was there in the late 60s. which is now, you see, almost 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I got a very interesting reaction from people. There were two kinds. There were people who said, oh, absolutely. He said, all we have to do is we just have to stagger the voting hours, you know, and then we get into issues of how that deprives people. Also talk about sealing ballots and not counting them till morning, and that could be done. That is, of course, a restraint of information. That is a very serious step to take in an environment like ours, but it could be done, and many people in the media are saying now that it should be done, not because they think they make any difference in the election, but because they think people don't like them. And if there's anything people in the media don't like, it's not to be liked. They, you know, if you really get mad at the media, it does frighten them. We saw examples of that. We've seen like of that with presidents, all three of the last presidents we've had. So far, you know, depending on whether you believe the polls or not, there isn't any evidence that an outcome of an election has been changed because of that phenomenon, an election for president, not even this last one. But I believe it could happen.
Well, couldn't they censor themselves and just report what is going on instead of making it?
Well,
that's
very hard. That's what I think the most likely effect, in fact, is going to be on people staying home from the polls and not voting for their local candidate. Mm-hmm. And that could be a serious. Mm-hmm. That's going to be an issue that's going to be with us, and people are going to be concerned about now for a while. And I think it's a legitimate one. I must say that I don't think the answer is one that somebody gave me one time when I was with Senator Mondale. And that was, I don't think we should change it. And I said, well, you know, doesn't it seem to you to be unfair? Yes, it's unfair. But, you know, the East Coast tends to be Democratic. And therefore, it's a great advantage to us to have that happen. I just want to suggest to you that sometimes people are self-serving when they think about it. Yeah.
I would just like get some of your perspective. I think there's seems to be a general opinion that the quality of national leadership and the choice of candidates that we have today is really poor. People keep asking, where are the truly great leaders? And I was wondering if it's just because we know so much about people these days and
are you talking about presidential candidates primarily, or do you think, or are you talking
in
general?
I think people really, I've heard it so much that, gee, where are the really...
Okay.
But
let me tell you some things that I think are happening. I think that it is becoming a more and more crummy job to be an elected official in the United States, and fewer people are willing to do it. Fewer really good people. I really despair of that. On the other hand, I don't think I've ever seen more dedicated people. There are more people coming into political offices who are really committed. Now, I don't like some of the things some of them are committed to, but I think we ought to be careful not to judge leadership or not to judge quality on the basis of whether we necessarily whether we agree with the ideology of the person or not. I was really impressed about 2 months ago. I went to an event. I heard Barry Goldwater speaking. As you know, Barry Goldwater is very old now. He's been ill. And he was lamenting the death of Hubert Humphrey. And the point that he made seemed to me to be a very a good one. He was making essentially the complaint you're making about the lack of leaders. The point he was making is that it is impossible to be a good conservative unless you have good liberals, really thoughtful ones, against whom to test your ideas. That the exchange, the advocacy that makes up our system is a very, very good test by fire. And the point is there do seem to me to be fewer people willing to go into that fire. And I don't know the explanation for that. I think there are some really fine ones. I can name new members of Congress, some of whom have spent
their youth, their young careers in state legislatures. For instance, I think of Martin Sable, Minneapolis. I think of Lowell Erdahl's brother, Arlen. One's a Democrat, one's a Republican. Both very fine, good, committed people. Poor Arlen, you see, has really been bounced around this year by the political winds in Minnesota. And right at this point, I can't tell you whether he's going to go back to Congress or not. If he does, it's going to be from a different district than the one he represented before, because he, in the business of redistricting, he came up against the super conservatives, and they went after him.
Financial disclosure effect.
Financial disclosure affects that to some extent. There are people who have income, who have wealth of some sort. It isn't so much that they don't, I think at least, it isn't so much that they don't want to report their wealth, but the sort of assumption that if you've got a conflict, you have to divest yourself of those things, means that for $70,000 lousy dollars a year, sounds like a lot of money, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. $70,000 lousy dollars a year when your income may be $150 or $200, you've got to throw away your investment portfolio and turn it over to somebody and lose control of it and pauperize yourself. Well, that hardly ever happens. But the point is, people don't have any privacy anymore. People don't have any privacy anymore, and if you're a member of Congress, you really don't, or a president. I mean, my God. They didn't even used to tell about Jack Kennedy and his carryings on. But you can hardly get out of office before they're telling on you now. Sometimes the press media tell on you before. Talk about media exercising restraint. They have done that many, many times. It's also true that there are unrealistic expectations, I think. I think it was Charlie the other day who said that maybe we ought to use David as an example. There was somebody, a king, you know, a guy who really got a lot done. Well, his character was far from perfect. But it's almost as if we have an expectation that people are going to behave in certain... But they got to achieve perfection in their behavior, personal behavior, in order for us to have any confidence in their political behavior. And I guess, you know, I'm guilty of that myself. I think that's right. But there are good people. I think we're going to... Well, by the way, our system of choosing presidential candidates has changed. There are a good many... We used to lament the smoke-filled rooms, you know, where the old pals got together, and we didn't really pick the candidate. You know, they picked them, and they had these people at the national convention, and they just kind of came out, and Mayor Daley and a few others got together, and they said, this is who your candidate for president's going to be. We fought that, and we changed so that we have primaries. And now we have a system where television ads and money, the amount of money you can spend on the primary campaign, where spending is not limited. Well, I shouldn't say that it is limited, where you can allocate your money in various ways to give you a particular kind of clout in primaries, and those who have the big names, and who are able to raise the kind of money that gets you the kind of matching money that really makes it possible for you to have a campaign, have the advantage, it seems to me. The people chose Jimmy Carter in a way that they had never chosen a president before. The people chose Ronald Reagan this time. Thank you. I'm sorry we don't have more time.